Since the dawn of civilization, mankind has been involved in warfare. Although it has evolved from sticks and stones to high-tech machinery, its essence has always been the same. Two sides that have a difference of opinion over something fight for their cause until A, one side defeats the other and imposes what they were fighting for on the losing side, or B, they decide to stop fighting and batter to Jesus and go on with their life. Okay, that might be a bit of an oversimplification. The causes of war are very complex in nature, ranging from imperialism, nationalism, and religious origins. While these are some of the traditional causes of war, they aren't what we're here to talk about today. On this episode of the podcast, we're going to focus on wars that started over bizarre reasons. Reasons that can only be described as some weird.
Welcome to the Some Weird Podcast, a podcast about strange and unusual stories told by us, a sister and brother team hailing from the island of Newfoundland. I'm your co-host, Chrissy.
And I'm your co-host, Barry. In this episode, we'll be delving into stories about some of the weirdest wars in history.
War is not generally a fun topic, but I promise that these are definitely going to be on the lighter side.
We've spoken a lot about war over the course of the podcast, whether it be the Cold War or World War II and things like that, and I think we're both a little bit out of history buffs.
A little bit. Here's a question for you. War, what is it good for?
Absolutely nothing.
Say it again.
That was my original intro, but I changed it.
Oh, nice. See, we do need to take a longer hiatus.
That's right.
Or maybe we're just on the same wavelength. Who knows? But anyway, we're going to talk about war here tonight. Let's call it the Reader's Digest, the Lighter Side of War segment. Brought
there
to you by the Some Weird Podcast.
Sounds good.
Let's get on the go.
Okay. I'm going to tell you about a war that happened over a football match.
Football like NFL or football like soccer?
Football isn't soccer.
Okay.
The beautiful game, if you will.
Is that its nickname?
You've never heard that before? Soccer's nicknamed the beautiful game? Yeah, that's what people call it. We'll call it soccer. If you're not listening from North America, we call it football soccer here.
No wars have been started over NFL, as far as I know, unless they're like small inter-family wars. So let's talk about a real football war.
Exactly. So soccer fans are among the most passionate in all of sports. People really take their team seriously. I'm a big fan of passion for your sports team. I'm a big diehard Cleveland Browns fan. I don't think that's a secret to anybody who knows me or anybody who's listened to this podcast. I'm sure I've mentioned it several times.
You're literally wearing a Browns shirt right now.
Yes, I am. It's probably why I'm angry all the time during football season because Cleveland Browns aren't very good.
Well, you got to stick by your team.
Yeah. And in sports, there's always rivalries, right? In the Browns, they have a huge rivalry against the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Baltimore Ravens. As a Browns fan, I hate both teams. Right. But again, I take it in good fun.
Yes.
But unfortunately, sometimes people take it too far. Lighthearted carrying on turns into full-blown violence over the outcome of the game. I've never really understood it. I mean, you see the players on the field who are getting paid millions of dollars to play. They're hugging each other after the game. Yet the fans who paid hundreds of dollars to watch them play are up there beating the shit out of each other.
Yeah.
I was actually at a Bills-Browns game one time in Buffalo, and one of the Buffalo Bills fans got very aggressive with me, got in my face, screaming at
you?
Me.
And personally?
Yeah, and like really was threatening and looked like they were going to hit me. My wife was very scared, but luckily I turned around and he walked away. So,
oh, wow.
American football fans like myself are very passionate about their teams, but now soccer fans, they take it to a whole nother level. I'm sure you've heard about soccer hooligans and hooliganism and all that.
Yes.
A lot of times, like, the fans of different teams got to be separated by thousands of police and all this kind of stuff. And there's lots of examples of soccer fans rioting and getting pretty out of hand.
Yeah.
Perhaps the most extreme example of this was in 1969 when a series of soccer matches between Honduras and El Salvador culminated in a full-blown military conflict that historians now refer to as the 100-Hour War or the Football War.
Oh, okay. Can't say I've ever heard of this one.
Now, it'd be inaccurate to say that these were countries friendly to each other prior to this, right? It's kind of like saying, World War One happened because Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated, but if that didn't happen, something else would cause it. It was ready to blow anyway, right? That was just the spark of the powder keg of Europe for thing, right? So,
in the words of the great Mr. Quinlan,
yes, that's
it
right.
was a powder keg.
And she was just ready to go up, and that was what sent her up.
Yep.
And no difference here. So there was definitely tensions between Honduras and El Salvador. So there are two Central American countries that border one another. Honduras is about five times bigger than El Salvador in terms of land size. But in 1969, El Salvador's population was 40% larger. So there's 3.7 million people in El Salvador, 2.6 million in Honduras.
Okay.
And starting in the 20th century, many Salvadorans, and again, if that's not the right vernacular for people from El Salvador, I apologize, but they began migrating to Honduras. In 1969, there's roughly 300,000 people from El Salvador living in Honduras. So in Honduras, much like many areas of Central America, the land is owned by big business. The United Fruit Company owned 10% of all the country's land. This company worked to create an alliance with other agricultural businesses of the area to create the National Federation of Farmers and Livestock Farmers of Honduras.
Okay.
The group became very powerful and used its influence to put pressure on the Honduras government to reform land laws. And they were also very El Salvadoran. In 1967, partially due from lobbying from this federation, the government passed a land reform law. So this law gave the land being used to El Salvadoran immigrants back to the government, and then it was redistributed to locally born Honduras people. You know how back in the day you built a house in the land and eventually you got squatters' rights and all that kind of stuff? Well, that's what we're talking about here. So I guess they had these land and it was in their family since the turn of the 20th century, and they finally said, you know what, that's Honduras land. You never had any legal right to it, so we're taking that and we're giving it back to the people of Honduras.
Oh, wow. That's not cool.
Yeah. So whether it was occupied legally or generations of people from El Salvador immigrants owned it, didn't matter. It was taken from them. And several people from El Salvador were expelled from the country regardless of how long they'd been there and all that. They just started deporting people. While this was going on, so while people were losing their land and getting kicked out of the country, the two countries were scheduled to play in a series of games to determine which country would qualify for the 1970 FIFA World Cup. The first game was played in Honduras. It was June 8th, 1969. The night before the game, Honduras fans gathered outside the hotel where El Salvador was staying, and they started making all kinds of noise, all kinds of racket, whatever they could to prevent the people from going to sleep. anyway, they didn't get a good night's sleep. The game ended up being won by Honduras, 1-0, which is zero for you non-soccer fans. You got to say nil for zero.
Really?
You never heard that before?
No, I don't know anything about soccer.
Oh. Like I said, the game was won by Honduras. They scored a last-minute goal. So after watching the game on TV, one fan, an 18-year-old by the name of Amelia Bolonas, B-O-L-O-N-A-S.
Bolonas. Oh, yeah. Amelia Bologna.
Yeah, Amelia Bologna. My Bologna. And again, I shouldn't make light of this because she ended up committing suicide due to El Salvador losing.
Holy shit. Okay.
I love Canada, but I would never take my life if they lost, especially in soccer, because they're not traditionally a very strong soccer country.
Well, obviously, there was something else going on with this person. That was the Archduke Franz Ferdinand assassination tipping point, right? Same thing.
Like you said, there's probably more going on than just El Salvador losing to Honduras. But in the country of El Salvador, this was considered an act of patriotism. She was seen as a martyr. She was actually given a state funeral that was broadcast on national TV. And the president, the government cabinet, and the football team actually walked behind her flag-draped coffin.
Okay, they made a big show of it, it sounds
like.
Yeah,
pretty much, yeah. So the second game of this series took place in El Salvador on June 15th. Just like in Honduras, the El Salvador fans made loud noises outside the Honduras hotel this time in an attempt to keep the players up. Due to the threat of violence that was escalating between the two countries, the Honduras team traveled from the hotel to the stadium in armored cars.
It's just a game, my God.
They take it serious.
I'm very flabbergasted by the story thus far.
Many fans brought pictures of Bolonas to the stadium. At the beginning of any soccer match or a football match, they play the national anthem of each country and they got the country's flag there. So instead of raising the Honduras flag during the national anthem, they raised a dirty rag in its place.
Shut up. Really?
Yeah. Now, you never get away with that today. I mean, that's just...
No.
That's just, you know, a lack of respect for the country, right?
Right.
So the game was won by El Salvador 3-0, and there was much rioting before, during, and after the game. Three people were killed as a result. And during the post-game interview, the manager of Honduras said of the tension surrounding the game, he said, I'm glad we lost, because what would have happened if they had won? Imagine the rioting that would have happened then, right? There were reports of Honduras fans getting beaten while trying to leave the stadium. And when word traveled to Honduras, there were some reports of El Salvador fans in that country getting beaten and riots between fans and everything else.
That's insane.
The tension is just, you know, you can cut it like a knife, as Gorilla Monsoon would say.
Yeah, okay.
Because each team won one game each, there's a third playoff game was to take place. Now, luckily, this one was being taken place on a neutral site. I think that's common protocol anyway, but it was definitely the right decision to make in this circumstance.
Right.
And it was going to be played in Mexico, which was actually the host country of the 1970 World Cup. So this game was played on June 27th, 1969. So during the game, El Salvador fans were chanting murderer, murderer, murderer to the Honduras team. And Honduras fans were seen with signs that said, nobody beats Honduras and we will avenge 3-0. So I guess they were quite upset about the last game. There was over 1,700 policemen assigned to the game. And on the same day of the game, El Salvador dissolved all diplomatic ties with Honduras. They started the escalating tensions from the last game that resulted in almost 12,000 El Salvadoran-born people fleeing Honduras after the football match started. They said Honduras didn't do anything to prevent the plunder, rape, and murder of their people, and in fact, they actually encouraged it.
I don't even know what comment to say about this. Okay.
So this game was won by El Salvador 3-2 on a last-minute goal.
Man.
So they ended up winning the chance to go to the World Cup.
Yeah.
Tensions continued between the two countries, and they finally erupted on July 14th, 1969, when El Salvador planes attacked Honduras.
Because of the football game?
Again, it's the powder keg. I mean, there was tensions for a while. I guess the football game was the spark that said, you know what, it's time to blow these guys up.
Oh, my God.
So they bombed several targets, including the airport, which made it difficult for Honduras to respond. Honduras did launch a counterstrike to one of the airports in El Salvador on the 16th. Fighting continued for 4 days that included airstrikes, mechanized infantry, armored vehicles, and El Salvador actually got to within striking distance of the Honduras capital.
Holy shit.
So on the 18th, Honduras had called upon the Organization of American States to intervene. I'm not exactly sure what that is, but I guess, you know, in Central America, a bunch of the countries kind of have like a pact where they all kind of get together. Maybe it's kind of like United Nations or NATO, but central to this area.
Mm-hmm.
And the group was 35 independent nations in a region that met to regulate affairs and things like that.
Right.
El Salvador resisted the intervention for several days and demanded Honduras pay reparations for the attacks on the El Salvador people and guarantee the safety of El Salvador people in Honduras.
Okay.
The ceasefire took effect on the 20th of July. Despite that, El Salvador continued until the 2nd of August to resist pressures to withdraw its troops. The combination of pressures led El Salvador to agree to withdrawal in the first days of August. Those pressures included the possibility of economic sanctions against El Salvador.
Mm-hmm.
And dispatch of Honduras to oversee the security of El Salvador people remaining in the country. The war lasted over 4 days, but it would take more than a decade to arrive at a final peace settlement.
Wow!
So the soccer game took 10 years of tension. This federation that was made were threatening very deliberate repercussions from El Salvador if they continued to resist withdrawing their troops. And Honduras guaranteed El Salvador president that Honduran government would provide adequate safety to the people living in Honduras.
Okay.
They also asked that reparations be paid to them citizens, but that was never accepted term of the ceasefire by Honduras. So what was the aftermath of the football war? Both sides suffered casualties. Some 300,000 people from El Salvador were displaced. Many have been forcibly exiled or fled the war-torn Honduras, only to enter El Salvador, in which the government was not welcoming of their return.
Holy cow!
After a fight over it. Most of the refugees were forced to provide for themselves with very little assistance. And over the next few years, more people from El Salvador returned to their native land, and they encountered overpopulation and extreme poverty. So they were better off where they were.
Yeah.
El Salvador suffered about 900 casualties, mostly civilians. Honduras lost about 250 combat troops and over 2,000 civilians over the four-day conflict.
Oh my God! This is a terrible story.
Yeah. And most of the war was fought in Honduran soil, and thousands were made homeless. Trade between Honduras and El Salvador had been greatly disrupted, and the border was officially closed. This damaged the economies of both nations tremendously, and El Salvador proceeded to lose all three matches of the 1970 World Cup.
And what, they didn't even friggin' win after all of that.
Two other quick things. The political power and military in both countries was reinforced. In the El Salvador legislation elections that followed, candidates of governing different parties are largely drawn from the ranks of the military. Having apologized for the role in the conflict, they proved very successful in the elections on the national and local levels. But in contrast, the gradual decriminalization process that characterized the 1960s, the military establishment would exercise increasing control. And the social situation in El Salvador worsened. The government proved unable to satisfy the economic needs of its citizens that were deported to Honduras. The resulting civil unrest was one of the causes of the Salvadoran Civil War, which followed a decade later, and 70,000 to 80,000 people died. And a further 8,000 more disappeared.
I mean, it sounds like just shit was not going well in the whole space around this time. Sports is something that will unite people as well as tear them apart. And this just sounds like a diversion of other real problems.
Yeah. So, and again, El Salvador proceeded to lose all three matches in the 1970 World Cup. So,
see, that's the fucking kicking the balls at the end.
At least if they won the whole thing, it would have been worth it all, right? So. But again, you know, the soccer match turned into a war, which turned into several thousand casualties, which ultimately led to the beginning of a civil war, in which a lot of people died. It was not all over a football game, and certainly the football game was the thing that finally ignited a long-standing civil unrest between the two nations.
Well, it was just something that people could get behind.
That's right. As most historians will say, you know, nationalism is a huge factor in terms of war. So, you know, cheering for your country is certainly a big part of nationalism, patriotism, and that type of thing. And when there's two countries that generally don't like each other and they're having a series of football matches in which, you know, people are fiercely loyal to their country and they love the sport and are very passionate about their sport and very passionate about their hatred for the other country, it just stirred up emotions to the point where they finally said, you know what, fuck it, roll the tanks.
Yeah.
That's the football war.
I didn't know anything about this story, and quite frankly, it's kind of mind-boggling that such a thing occurred.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So, that's messed up. I got to tell you, for some reason, I thought you were going to tell a fun little tale about something that happened at a football game, and then they had like this big, weird, fun rivalry, and then they all became best friends. But that was not the case at
all. That's definitely not what happened there.
Okay, I had too much of a sunny outlook on that. And I don't know why, because everything else I have an outlook on is dark and terrible. But anyway, yeah, the story I'm going to tell you is not nearly as scary and horrific, I guess. My weird war story is about the pig war. Let's get into it.
Isn't there a song, War Pigs or something? Like a Zeppelin or Sabbath or something like that?
Maybe. Zeppelin songs, many titles have nothing to do with whatever the fuck is going on in the song or about the song. So probably. I'm not sure. Let's get back to the War of Pigs. I mean, the Pig War, not the War of Pigs. What am I saying? Anyway, here we go.
The Bay of Pigs.
Thank you for saying, because in 1961, 1 month after the Bay of Pigs debacle, when American forces failed to do their most favorite Cold War activity of attempting to crush communism slash assassinate Cuban leader Fidel Castro, President John F. Kennedy addressed the Canadian Parliament during his official visit.
Do you think that the Cold War ended the day that Rocky beat Ivan Drago?
I would say that that was the first step into the downfall of communism and therefore the end of the Cold War.
It was. And the acceptance of the Russian people for the Italian stallion, I think it really went a long way.
I know you don't like much me too much, no, neither. Anyway.
That's right.
Whatever
you say. I can change. And you can change. We can all change.
He suddenly turns into Oprah Winfrey. Are you done with your Rocky?
I'm done with Rocky, yeah. So, all right. he addressed the Canadian Parliament.
There you go. Okay. In his speech on that day, Kennedy described the relationship between Canada and the United States as follows. Geography has made us neighbors. History has made us friends. Economics has made us partners. And necessity has made us allies. Those whom nature hath so joined together, let no man put asunder. These words are inscribed on the U.S. Embassy in Ottawa. And it's a lovely sentiment written by a talented speechwriter and spoken by an incredibly charismatic man. And while we think of Canada and the U.S. as some of the greatest allies today, we're probably the BFF record book when it comes to international relations with our largest unguarded border and similar cultures. This was not always the case.
What was the thing about something about necessity made us friends? Is that what it said?
History has made us friends. Necessity has made us allies.
Necessity. Is that really a glowing endorsement?
I don't know. I mean, the line in that makes me go, what the fuck, buddy? Is those whom nature hath joined together, let no man put asunder. Like, isn't that wedding vows? Right?
I don't know. But Kennedy was a great orator. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. He could be an Ein Berliner and whatnot.
As you said, the Simpsons, let me respond with yet another flippant remark.
Yes. Great, we got wrestling and The Simpsons. As soon as we get to Back to the Future, the trifecta is complete.
We'll get there.
We will, probably. United States and Canada today were, you know, great allies, great friends, unguarded border, all that shit. But it wasn't always the case. Remember, America had a whole bloody revolution against England to gain its independence in 1776, while Canada remained loyal until 1867, when it just sort of politely asked if it could make its own country. Back then, the United States and England, and therefore the colony of Canada, were not friends. Of course, if you were to think of a war between future BFFs, you might first think of the War of 1812. But while this may be the most famous post-revolutionary spat, it was not the only one. My story for this episode of the Some Weird Podcast is the incredibly bizarre and obscure story of the Pig War between the United States and the future country of Canada. As early European settlers in the Americas were finding out just how humongous the New World was, all hands were in a mad dash to claim up as much of that sweet land as possible. They pushed and pressed their way in, eventually making it all the way from the good old island of Newfoundland on the Far East Coast to the Pacific. And they had a pretty weird method of claiming land. Basically, it was kind of like claiming dibs. If an explorer was able to see land and name it, then it was claimed for him and his empire. They did not even need to physically touch the land. It just needed to be vaguely in their line of sight. For some reason, this seemed like a great method for getting more territory, regardless of the fact that other people were already living there. And this fancy empire expansion tactic was exactly how a small group of islands east of Vancouver Island and west of Washington State got their name. A Spanish explorer by the name of Francisco de Eliza saw them way back in 1791 and exclaimed, "Them islands are Spanish, and I'm calling them the unoriginal name St. John's Islands, because I don't feel like the New World has quite enough St. John's in them yet," or something roughly to that effect. Everything was named St. John's. Of course, he was a Spanish explorer, so he said all that in Spanish, and from that day to this, those islands have been known as the San Juan Islands. Shortly thereafter, via a series of diplomatic negotiations, Spain pretty much gave up its claim to the Pacific Northwest, leaving but two remaining world powers in the area, England and the United States. Now, anyone who looks at a current world map can see that a good amount of the border between the U.S. and Canada is a nice straight line at the 49th parallel. It's as if those who put themselves in charge of creating the border of these two countries just kind of looked at it and said, "Fuck it, we'll just draw a straight line right there, and north is Canada and south is the United States." And essentially, that's what they did in 1818.
I've always wondered how they come up with borders. How does that actually work?
That's exactly what they did. They're just like, "We're going to start here and just make a line. That's yours and this is ours."
Okay.
But at that time, back in 1818, when they drew that incredibly straight line, the Oregon Territory, which included portions of modern-day British Columbia, Washington State, Oregon, and some other land, were jointly occupied by the United States and Canada, i.e. the English colony. By 1846, Americans were balls deep in the Manifest Destiny dream of owning all of North America, but neither the British nor the Americans wanted to go to war about it. After all, the Americans were already at war with Mexico over the Southwest. They can only fight so much at a time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's basically when they said California, that's ours, Nevada, ours, New Mexico, that's ours, all that, right? So both sides signed the Oregon Treaty, which extended that straight border all the way to the Pacific Ocean. This seemed like a great compromise between the two future BFFs, but the thing about coastal geography is it's not a straight line. Part of the treaty was explicit that the British would keep Vancouver Island, even though it dips well below the 49th parallel, so there's no dispute there. But it also said that after the border hits the Strait of Georgia, the border would go south through, quote, the middle of the channel. That seemed pretty good at first glance, but it's actually pretty ambiguous because there's at least three different channels that it could be referring to. Depending on which channel you thought the channel was, the San Juan Islands could either be British or American. Since the treaty signers were a bazillion miles away, not much consideration was given to the question of the exact channel that the treaty meant. However, both American and British settlers in that region wanted those islands. A British man named Griffin set up a sheep farm on San Juan Island, figuring that this would strengthen the British claim to it. However, when the Americans discovered the sheep farm on the island that they believed to be theirs, they demanded to collect customs on the sheep. When the British refused, the Americans sheep-napped 34 breeding rams as payment.
Jeez.
Yeah, but the official decision on who owned the islands was still not made. Then, gold was discovered near the area in 1858.
That makes decisions pretty quick.
Yes, it does. And this brought tons of Americans seeking their fortune. Of course, as we know, very few people actually got rich on these gold rushes, but instead of going all the way home, about a dozen or so Americans decided that they would just go ahead and settle right on San Juan Islands. After all, it was American territory as far as they knew. One such American was a young man named Lyman Cutler. He made a real estate decision that almost changed the course of history. Instead of finding an unoccupied area of the disputed territory, he decided to go ahead and build a house right on Griffin's sheep run. Since he was setting up his very own homestead, Lyman decided a potato garden would do nicely. Even though he was setting up a farm where animals already lived, he didn't bother to put up a fence. "But sheep don't eat potatoes," I hear you say. That's true, but sheep weren't the only animals on the British man's sheep farm. There was also a Berkshire pig, and if mob movies have taught us anything, it's that pigs will eat anything. The young American farmer found himself having to shoo that pig away from his precious potatoes on several occasions, and eventually he warned the British farmer to keep his animal away. But a pig's got to do what a pig's got to do, and finally the poor Berkshire pig rooted his last potato when Cutler reached his last straw and shot the pig.
Oh no.
To his credit, he felt some remorse, and he went to the pig's owner, Griffin, and offered to pay him $10 in compensation. But this was quickly denied, as this was a special pig and worth at least $100. Now, $100 back then was an outrageous amount of money, and Lyman just refused to pay. So Griffin went to the local British governor to complain about this heinous act. In response, the governor sent authorities to take Lyman into custody and bring him to the undisputed British territory of Victoria, which is on Vancouver Island, for trial. Word of the British attempting to arrest an American on American soil and try him in a British court reached the ears of an American general by the name of William Harney, and he was having none of that. Harney had a reputation of being a bit of a loose cannon, and he was described as both an imbecile and a laughingstock. Also, he hated the British. He saw this incident as a way to capture glory that he so richly deserved. His plan was to get the Americans on the island to request military protection. Then, when the British saw the American military setting up on the island, they'd be so pissed off that they'd declare war, which he would fight and win and get the glory. Starting a war over a pig seems insane, but historians think that Harney was not just an idiot. Rather, since this was 1858 and Harney was a slave-owning Southerner, they think that this may have been his attempt to shift focus from the looming threat of the American Civil War. Either way, the American military set up base on the disputed territory of San Juan Island. Meanwhile, a British official was sent to the island to settle the whole pig thing, but instead of mediating between two farmers, he found himself met with American soldiers. In response, the British governor sent the British Navy over to tell the Americans to leave. Jeez. But when they got there, they found even more Americans than they expected. They just don't know what the fuck is going on here.
God.
The British governor thought that they should send even more troops.
An arms race.
And then they should arrest the American officers. But one British naval officer talked him out of it. Fine, he said. Just send a couple of ships and keep an eye on them Americans. In a weird twist, this situation attracted tourists to go see if a war was actually going to break out. So they would get boats of tourists coming to see the Americans and the British at a standstill at this San Juan Island.
So the British had like this couple of battleships there and just staring at them. So let's watch, see what they're doing.
Yep.
Make sure they don't harvest a pig. That's our bacon.
Or the 1858 equivalent of a battleship.
The hood. Oh, sorry.
The hood.
The hood meaning the boat that found the Bismarck on that fatal day.
Yes.
And the Bismarck started firing 50 miles away. Anyway.
Who sang that? Oh, Johnny Horton.
Johnny Horton, sing the Bismarck.
Well, I just pick right on up.
Yeah, give her.
Okay, so we left off with Taurus. Here we go. Finally, someone with some sense came along, a rear admiral in the British Navy, and he said, "You guys are all stupid and everyone has to hold your horses until the big guys can figure this out." When American President James Buchanan heard about this nonsense, he sent a general to settle it. Then cooler heads prevailed from both sides, and they decided to demand that they call off the weird, almost pig war. So no one lost face. It was decided that both militaries would jointly occupy the island. The British and the American troops actually got along really well on the tiny little island, and the British celebrated the 4th of July with their new American friends, and the Americans helped celebrate Queen Victoria's birthday.
A.K.A. May 24?
Yes, A.K.A. May 24. They all went out to the gravel pits. They got some Coleman wieners up to Sobeys. Anyways.
Yeah, that's right.
In 1861, civil war broke out in the United States, and Americans had bigger things to worry about. So things stayed as they were for San Juan Island until 1872, when the issue went to international court for arbitration. In the end, the islands were determined to be American territory.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The British military left the island peacefully, but they took the flagpole as a joke so that there'd be nowhere to hoist Old Glory. Today, there's a national park on San Juan Island, and here, at the site of the British military camp, American Rangers of the National Park Service raise and lower the Union Jack, making this one of the very few places in the country where the flag of a foreign nation is flown. And that is a very weird story of the pig war.
Couple questions. Question number one, did they harvest the pig for the bacon and the pork chops?
That is not something that I've came across in any of my research, but I would guess that as a farmer, they probably did harvest the pig, yes. But I do not know.
Yeah. Understand that in the grand scheme of the story, that has very little merit.
It's a valid question.
These islands, are they part of Washington State?
They are part of Washington State, yes.
So the rationale for it to be considered American soil was that whatever canal they discovered, this was the canal that they were referring to? And this
the
is...
channel, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
San Juan Island is the biggest island in this little group of islands, and they're very, very, very tiny. But through them, there's at least three similarly sized channels that you could go through. So there's one on the east, one in the middle, one on the west. And when it went to international arbitration, they found that the westerlymost channel was the channel that the treaty was referring to. And it was actually the German chancellor was the person that was in charge of making that decision.
Kaiser Wilhelm.
Yep. I actually thought that before I knew the outcome that he would have sided on the British side because, you know, the British royal family are all German anyway. Nope. He went with the Americans.
Okay.
Yeah, the pig war. Nobody died. It was way less crazy than your war.
Yeah, where several people died.
The pig was the only casualty.
So there you have it. Weird stories about weird wars.
What do you think about these stories? You can share your ideas with us at someweirdpodcast@gmail.com.
Or on the Twitter @someweirdpod or the Instagram machine, someweirdpod.
Or our website, someweirdpodcast.com.
If you haven't done so already, please follow or subscribe wherever you listen so you'll never miss an episode.
And if you've enjoyed this episode and you want to help us out, please leave us a 5-star review wherever you listen so that others can discover us. And before I tell you not to be afraid to tell a friend about the Some Weird Podcast, I know a lot of our listeners don't use the Twitter, but we do have a poll out there, so I'm going to throw it out there and you guys can reach out to us by our email, Instagram, Twitter, whatever, however you want. For our final episode of the season, we are going to dedicate to stories from Newfoundland like we always do. We have four different ideas to do. Pirates, tables, statues, or whatever the hell we want. So if you have a preference of any of those things, shoot us an email, reach out on the Instagram, or reach out on the Twitter, whatever you want.
These stories are somewhere by.
Some weird.
You know Tim Robinson won the Emmy for Best Comedic Performance in a Sketch Comedy for that show?
I'm kind of surprised at that because it's a pretty obscure show, I think.
Yeah, it's very niche, I think.
It's very, very funny.
I think it's hilarious.
I think you should leave is just absurd. Like, why are you in a Trans Am at a funeral with a trunk full of porn? Like,
trunk full of porn.
Like, what is that?
Friday night. I'm thinking that it just...
Or like sloppy steaks.
Get sloppy steaks. Steak with the water on them. No sloppy steaks tonight, guys. Please. What do you think we are? Piece of shit.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I used to be a piece of shit.
Really worried that she doesn't think the baby can change. I'm jet lagged, sir. I mean jet lagged. Been here for 10 days. He's not eating because he's spending all his per diem money on shirts at Dan Flashes. You shut the fuck up, dog, you fucking skunk.